So, Graham, why don't you tell us about how you came to write your book and what your book is about?
Sure. I've suffered from depression and anxiety most of my life, pretty much since as long as I can remember, actually. And I made a faith commitment when I was about 18 years old, and through that faith commitment, I started to find some real sort of answers as to actually what was causing the depression, what, you know, the forces behind it that were driving it, and that sort of thing. And I'd sort of struggled a bit with a lack of purpose and a lack of direction. I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. I knew I was learning a lot about this affliction, and I knew there was a lot of people out there that had suffered from it too, but I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. And then just through a conversation with a friend of mine, he had written a book himself, and he actually said to me, I just offhand threw out a comment saying, "Oh, I've thought of writing a book someday too." And he said to me, "Oh, if you write one, I can help you get it published." And I just felt very strongly once he said that that's what I was meant to do. So I set about writing a book just about my life story and my walk through this affliction and the things I've learned from it. And I began the journey of writing it in May 2010, I think.
And that explains the title, No Way Out But Through.
Yep.
Now, do you consider depression a mental illness, or do you consider it a product of one's environment?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I think it's a little bit of both. And I know for me, in my background, there were some parts of it that were definitely caused due to chemical imbalances in the brain. I did smoke a bit of marijuana in my teenage years, and I do believe that lowered the serotonin levels in my brain quite a bit, so I did have to take some medication just to bump it back up to normal. But I've also, I do also believe it's very much a product of your environment as well. My journey through it with me has had me learning about sort of wrong thinking, suppressed subconscious wrong thinking that, causes sort of, pain, anxiety, distress, and that sort of thing. And it's been, as I've learned to identify that and face it, that's how I've sort of found my path to getting better.
I see. So do you think mental illness in general, and now, like, I know there's a lot of misconceptions about what is mental illness, because a lot of people think, well, mental illness is crazy, for lack of a better term. But through my personal experience with divorce, death in the family, things like that, depression can be crippling.
Yeah,
I mean, I've been there myself, there's a few times in my life that stick out, pretty well in my head. But sure. Do you think, basically what I'm asking, how would you define mental illness? I mean, is it a chemical imbalance? Is it genetic? Is it learned behavior that becomes serialized? Or do you think it's a combination of all of those and more?
Yeah, I would say from my experience, it's been a combination of all of those things. I think with different people in different cases, it can be sort of any of the above. Like, some people, it may just be learned behavior. It may just be circumstantial. It may just be inherited stuff, or it may just be a chemical imbalance. But then you get other people where it's a combination of any one of those things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you for or against medication for depression?
Yes and no. I see. I certainly see the merit in it. It definitely helped me at a time when my serotonin levels were lower in my brain. It helped me to get them back up to normal, which was healthy. But at the same time, I'd been taking it for 8 years, and I was very much sort of kind of sort of a zombie most of the time. And then I sort of felt at one point that it wasn't doing me any good anymore and I needed to start coming off it. And then when I started coming off it, I went through all these crazy withdrawal symptoms and it was just awful. And I realized how much of an effect the chemicals have been having on my body. So yes, I agree with it, but when it's needed, but at the same time, you know, I'm not on anything these days, and I feel better than I ever have. So,
so sometimes you don't. So sometimes it wouldn't be that you're taking, you know, that you're taking medication for life. So it could be just to get you through a rough patch, or to get you through the anxiety and depression you feel, you know, based on that point in your life. Would you say that that's true, or?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yep, yeah. There's, I went through burnout in 2011. Had a nervous breakdown. Just had too much going on, and at that point, I'd reduced the dosage I was taking by quite a bit, but I bumped it up. Oh, the doctor bumped it up quite a bit after that, just to help me cope and get through that period.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that in addition to the meds and the therapy, that writing No Way Out But Through was therapeutic in and of itself, because I couldn't picture writing a book like that without facing the demons, so to say. I don't know how else to say it, but I mean, was it therapeutic, and how hard was it to write that book?
It was extremely therapeutic, actually. I had struggled a lot with the sort of a lack of purpose at times, and I'd wondered why I'd been through this journey and what was going on and that sort of thing. It was a bit of both. And like I struggled with the lack of purpose, and but then once I decided to write the book, then I found a real sense of purpose. And so it was really inspiring in that sense. But yes, it was certainly hard to write through, but it was therapeutic as well, because yes, you are walking through the darkest places of your own life, but you also know that you're doing it for the purpose of giving someone else help, hope and inspiration when they need it.
Now, also in writing the book, do you find that part of the therapeutic process in writing the book is the fact that it's in the past and it's hindsight? Do you find that helped a little bit? Because you know the old saying, hindsight is 20/20. Do you think that gave you some clarity when you wrote the book, that you know you're not seeing it from the eyes of the moment?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I sort of found that it helped give me closure on quite a few things, and it really helped give me a perspective on a lot of years where I just felt I was wandering in sort of a place of just being and just feeling lost and sort of in this place of constant confusion. And it just helps give me a sense of purpose for those years, I suppose, because I was able to write about my experiences during those, you know, dark times, those lean times, and instead of just feeling terrible because of these years that were wasted, I can look back and say, well, those years were, you know, they've given me experiences which have gone into a book which can now, you know, go out to help those who need it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Now, if it's all right with you, you don't have to answer this next question, but what were the life events that caused you to go through that severely rough patch?
Through the burnout thing. There was a few things actually. I was working very long hours in the job I was doing, and then every evening and every weekend I was coming home and I was writing the book as well. So I was pretty much working 24/7, and then I had a couple of medical things that happened. Like I had an old stomach ulcer that started bleeding again, and had some social things happen as well. And sort of everything just sort of compiled on me at once, and it just sort of pushed me over the edge.
It was one thing after another, basically. Yeah. And yeah. Well, and you're also a musician. Yep. What instruments do you play?
I play guitar and also play drums as well, and experiment with bass guitar a bit. And I'm just starting to learn to sing as well.
Nice. So yeah, we're identical, and except the singing, you wouldn't want to hear me sing. So you know, but that you know, but let me put it to you this way. Do you think that your skills as a musician helped at all, helped or hindered?
Oh, absolutely. I sort of found, especially in my teenage years when I just didn't really have much hope, I didn't really have much to go by, I sort of just felt a bit lost, and I found a real solace in just picking up the guitar. And I remember when I first figured out how to play the bass line on my mum's old acoustic guitar for the song Polly by Nirvana. As soon as I figured out how to play that, I was the happiest guy ever. And that really set me on a journey, and it just gave me something to hold on to and something to aim for in those tough years. And I did kind of use it in a therapeutic manner as well, as it sort of gave me a bit of an escape as to what was going on.
Yeah, and that actually makes me think of another question concerning Nirvana. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the Kurt Cobain story and how his life was and ended up. And he suffered from lifelong depression, and you know, and he had stomach ulcers as well. And you know, well, he also had a heroin addiction that he mm-hmm. used as. And I think he said it in a few interviews, particularly an interview in the spring of '93 in Milan, Italy, where he said that he had used heroin, you know, as a medication.
Yeah.
I think you've heard of that as well.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Do you think, let's use him as an example, because his music is brilliant.
It is.
But, you know, it's obviously, you know, a byproduct of his illness. You know, do you think it's worth it to go that route, you know, to become to write about, you know, your illness the way he did, but then not treat it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think what Kurt did, you know, I mean, yes, he gave inspiration and hope and encouragement to a lot of people when they really needed it. He gave them someone to relate to when they really needed it, myself included. But at the same time, you know, he never really found a solution for his own problems, and they never went away. I mean, there's a lot of people who try and say, oh, you know, he died because he got too famous, or he died because he'd been doing drugs, or he died because his marriage was failing. And you know, people come up with all these things, but I think it's actually Chris Novoselic who actually said it the best when he said what killed Kurt was inexplicable internal forces. And that was what I really believe was the truth about him. And I did remember a quote saying about that those who were closest to him felt that they never really knew him at all. And you know, people who have those inexplicable internal forces, as I feel I've had in my life, are very much like that. You know, they can, you know, they paint a million different pictures of who they are, have a million different masks, but none of them are true. So, I mean, I admire Kurt for doing the best he could, you know, with his life. But, yeah, it does seem painfully obvious to me that, you know, he never really found a solution and an answer to what he was carrying within himself, and that drove him to do what he did.
Now, a lot of people say he never, you know, a lot of his friends have said through the years in interviews that they never saw that coming. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, so when someone gets depressed enough, and another instance is Robin Williams. None of his friends said they saw that coming. Not, you know, and I believe Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal were his best friends, and they had no clue. And his wife had no clue, and his, you know, and his children had no clue. And you know, so people that have ended up like Kurt Cobain and Robin Williams, you know, how do you know what the signs are?
Oh yeah, it's difficult to say, I guess, but I mean, because a lot of times people can be very secretive about what they're going through. But I do remember an interview with Kurt's aunt where she said that she'd always felt that he was an unstable person even before he got into fame. And then, like, you know, he's got lyrics in, you know, one of the songs on In Utero, you know, Look on the Bright Side is Suicide and that sort of thing. So I think people do leave, you know, hints and clues and stuff, but they're too often other people just don't pick up on them, or they don't see them for what they are. I do actually remember reading an interview with Billy Connolly a few days ago, and he said that he and Robin Williams were good friends, and not long before he died, Robin was on the phone to him, and Robin kept telling Billy, "I love you, I love you, I'm so grateful for your friendship, I love you." And Billy didn't understand it at the time, but after what happened, you know, Billy said to himself, "I think that was his way of saying goodbye, and I didn't pick up on it at the time." So I think there are signs there, it's just they're not always that easy to see.
Yeah, and well, in particular, in hindsight, you know, going back to hindsight again, do you think maybe in Robin Williams' case, maybe like it was like Kurt Cobain's music, his comedy was a byproduct of his depression?
Absolutely. You know, depressed people can be some of the funniest people you'll ever meet in your life. I've heard people say that about Kurt Cobain as well, that he had an amazing sense of humor and that he was hilarious. But the same thing, it's coming out of the sickness, and I think I think for Kurt it was music, I'd say for Robin it was his movies. They look at those things as like a medication, as something to solve their internal problems. But if they what always happens is, you know, with any sort of medication like that, it loses its effect after a while, and then they've still got what they had. Yeah. You know, Robin Williams still had his comedy and Kurt still had his music, but it wasn't working for them in the same way, and they sort of begin to think, oh, well, what have I got now? You know, I've had this to help me with everything, and it's not working anymore.
So, yeah. And another comedian, actually, that comes to mind, I read his book a long, long time ago, maybe 15, 16 years ago, Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, yeah.
Suffered massively from depression. And if you notice, his comedy, his whole comedy routine revolved around him not getting respect.
True.
And he didn't, you know, and he had 40 years of material, you know, and with people like Rodney Dangerfield, Robin Williams, Kurt Cobain, and many, many, many others, you know, they basically tell you that they're depressed and what they're depressed about. It's just that, you know, maybe, do you think maybe the packaging that they put it in, which is their music or their comedy or their movies, do you think maybe that sugarcoats it, or we lose the meaning because it's put into such a poetic form?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes people just don't see it for what it is. I remember hearing an interview with the guy Charles R. Cross, who wrote the biography Heavier Than Heaven about Kurt Cobain, and he said that a lot of the general sort of idealism about what Kurt said in his interviews and everything is that he was just a very cynical, very, very sarcastic sort of person. I don't think he said that a lot of people never really caught on just how much he was really struggling with everything. And yeah, a lot of the time, especially with comedy and that sort of stuff, it can be a really good front, you know, and people get to just think, oh, you know, someone like Robin Williams or something, he's a comedian, he makes people laugh, he must be the happiest guy ever. But, you know, if something is driving it that's not right, you know, it can lead them to do something like that. But because, you know, it's packaged in such a funny, you know, such an appealing manner, you know, people won't see that.
And do you also think maybe because they're making so much money at it that people just, you know, that's the last thing they assume, is that those people are depressed?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, I think it's everyone's dream in a lot of ways to get rich and, you know, be famous and that sort of thing. And they think that'll solve everything and make it go away. And, you know, I have heard that being worded at times. You know, you see a lot of the celebrities who do, you know, end up going the way of suicide and depression and that sort of thing. And there is a few of them. You know, those guys have got the money and everything. They've got the money and the fame, the recognition, but they've realized that, you know, it's not meeting the deeper human need. It's not solving the problems they're carrying within themselves. And if anything, all it really does is buy them a bit of an escape for a while. It's like, oh, I'm depressed, so I'll just go out and buy a jet ski or something, and then I'll go and I'll feel better. And then, but eventually, that'll lose its ability to distract you from your own problems. So you'll go, oh, I'll go buy something else. But eventually, it just sort of all catches up with you, and you realize that despite all the money, you're still living a hollow existence.
And I've wondered that about certain, like, I don't know, famous people. I mean, I'm not going to mention names, but you know, sometimes like the ones that have that. That aura about them where something might be wrong or going wrong in their life, you know, you find out that they've got 20 houses and 100 cars and, you know, I mean, just all sorts of just crazy stuff, you know, and I think, like, I mean, and I've got friends like that are so much in debt, you know, because they go on these shopping sprees, and then when they're not, they just don't seem whole. Like, I mean, like people, like the iPhone 6 coming out last week, for an example, I know people that traded in I know a person that traded in a 3 week old Android just to get that, because they have to have the latest and greatest. They're not happy if they've got if they've got the previous generation hardware. And I think that ties into what we're talking about.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's just consumerism, you know. I mean, that, you know, the whole marketing system is great, is all geared towards, oh, if you get this, if you have the latest and greatest, the latest thing that does this and also does this as well, then you're going to be happy. And so, you know, people buy into that, and it's a never ending cycle, because they keep on buying all these things, but the problem remains. And so they go, and they don't realize the problem remains. They just still keep thinking, oh, if I just get this next thing after I've got this thing I've got now, then I'll be happy. And it's like, you know, it's just a repetitive cycle that, you know, it'll go on forever if you let it.
And most people don't realize with the iPhone 6, it's 99% iPhone 5. You know, it's official. It's a stretched out iPhone 5 is what it is. You know,
I've got the 5S myself, and I looked at the specs on the 6 just out of curiosity, and the hardware is pretty much exactly the same.
99% the same. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so there's no reason to upgrade. I know people that are still using 3S's, so and they don't complain. But well, let me ask you this, sure. And you know, based on what we had just gotten done talking about with you being a musician, how has your music changed, your original music, from, you know, the time that, you know, that episode of your life through now?
I've actually found that, you know, as I've become more whole in myself, I've actually found I've become a much better player. I've actually found I've become a little bit more confident, a little bit more ambitious with my playing, a little bit less, a little bit more able to take on things. I mean, I used to tell everyone, oh, I'm never going to sing, I can't sing, I'm hopeless. But now, you know, I'm giving it a go, I'm learning, and I'm getting better. And a part of that, you know, comes from being stronger and more confident in myself. So it's made me more expressive and, you know, able to look at something like that and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to give this a go. And I think it's made me a little bit more creative in terms of my playing, a little bit more relaxed, because I don't have all the tension and everything driving me to make sure I hit the perfect note and make sure I absolutely write the most amazing thing that anyone else has ever written ever. I think it's because I'm not as hard on myself as what I used to be. I've actually become a better musician as a result.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and you know, as a musician too, I mean, if you're not hard on yourself about your playing and stuff, sometimes the mistakes sound brilliant.
Yeah, that's
you know, I've done that many a times, you know. But well, and you know, that brings me to my next point. with Jammer Direct being a network of unsigned artists, independent artists from around the world, of course, a lot of them would want to be signed and everything. But I also notice, and this is something that we freely admit here, with the way, you know, Jammer Direct was set up until June, you know, there was a way to not only send positive vibes to each member, but negative vibes. And we saw, and that became a legitimate problem with, with, you know, Jammer Direct's profiling system was people, you know, dissing each other's bands, you know, I guess you'd call it the haterade, which is what we called it internally, and where they just went out of their way not everybody, but some people went out of their way to cut on others, and then they would, then the feuds would spill out on the Twitter and Facebook, you know, and all that. And I guess my question is in two parts. First part is what's the point of wasting energy, downing others when you could better yourself? And then number two, if that's happening to you, how do you combat that?
Yeah, I mean, it's that's a good question. I actually just think you know, when it comes down to unresolved, you know, tension issues in your own life, you know, what I've found from my experience is that, you know, you're always looking for an outlet. You know, you're looking for something to get offended about. You're looking for something to blame. You know, you're looking for something or someone else that you can tear down because it'll make you feel a bit, you think it'll make you feel a bit better about how you are and the place that you're in at the time. And so when you see a band that you don't like or something, you know, another unsigned band or something who's in the same boat as you, and, you know, you've got access to Twitter or something, so you've got the ability to make your voice heard, you know, it's very easy to subconsciously think to yourself, I don't like this band, so I'm going to go on Twitter and rip them to shreds because it's going to make me feel better about myself. And then, you know, maybe the people who are in that band, you know, will see that and be offended and will sit there and, you know, and, you know, have every right to be offended, but will sit there and will strike back. And it just ends up being a repetitive cycle that's just going on and on and on. And the way I've found to combat that sort of thing is I've just learned to say, well, you know, you need to, I've learned I need to look at myself first and need to, you know, clear my own heart, you know, face the wrong thinking in my life that's looking for that outlet. And as I've found that, I've actually found it's just easier and safer, and it breaks the cycle to actually just sit there and just ignore things like that and just let them go.
Comfortable with yourself. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then how, you know, so you're like, I totally agree, because I've seen it so many times, and what kills it the quickest is ignoring it.
Yeah, it does.
Because they're, you know, because when somebody's trying to bully you on Facebook, Twitter, Jammer Direct, Reverb Nation, MySpace, just on any social medium, they're trying to bait you. We call it fish on a hook. They want you to take a bite, and their worst nightmare is for you to just not acknowledge them.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, they're looking for a response. You know, they're looking to see that you know, that what they've said is acknowledged. But if you don't acknowledge them and you don't validate them, if you just sit there and just ignore them, and it's a hard pill to swallow, because, you know, the default human nature is what that comment says offends me, so I want to strike back, and that's the default nature. But, you know, when everyone, you know, utilizes that same nature, it just ends up with endless fighting fire with fire, and, you know, it never ends.
Becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah, and so one person's got to sit there and they've just got to say, you know, I've just got to, you know, I've got to be the bigger person in this, and I've got to break the cycle, and I've got to realize that person lashing out at me, they're actually looking for a resolution to their own problems, and I'm not going to give them the illusion of doing that by responding to their offensive comments.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I've got a personal story where I learned that, actually, because I learned it the hard way. you know, I was in my early 20s and I was in college and I studied to be a computer developer, a software app developer, you know, so computer science was my major. One of the professors was a transfer professor from MIT, you know, so, he's well known in the software industry. So I was very, very, very lucky to be in his class, you know, so, you know, because I mean, it was almost like, you know, having Eddie Van Halen teach you, you know, be your guitar teacher. So, you know, but the thing was, you know, like, okay, our first project, you know, we turned in, it was just a simple app, you know, and it had to do certain functions, it had to do all the functions that were on the chalkboard, and it had to add the GUI, which is graphic user interface, which, you know what that is. That's what you see, you know, the interface that you see. And, I was all proud of what I did and stuff. And when he got to mine, from my point of view, he totally gutted it. Didn't say worst piece of crap, but I heard worst piece of crap he's ever seen, you know. Wow. But and you know what the funny thing is, I totally lashed out on him with all my friends and fellow students. I was like, he doesn't know what he's talking about, he sucks, he's here because he got fired from MIT, you know, all this stuff. And I was really, really mad, because here's one of my mentors ripping me apart. And then here's the thing. What I realized was I wasn't angry at him. I was angry because he made me feel devastated and I took his criticism wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I went back to the notes, he wasn't gutting me at all. He was just saying, you know, in a nice way how I had overlooked certain rules of the assignment. And I owed him an apology. But do you think maybe that like anger, it, like in stuff like that, especially with cyberbullying and stuff like that, anger is a byproduct of the devastation you feel because that you feel that person wronged you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I actually have a similar story. When I was first written my book, I thought it was just the greatest thing ever. And I arranged to get it sent off to a professional editor. And I was expecting they were going to come back to me and say, oh, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen. We don't need to make any changes sort of thing. And I was sitting there in my little, you know, cloud nine. And they came back to me with, you know, just, yeah, you need to change this. You need to change this. You need to add something out here. You need to take this out here. This part's not good enough. And I felt the same way. I was absolutely devastated. I was like, this is my baby. You can't do this. You know, I was really upset. But eventually I realized that I just had to get over myself, because what they were saying was actually, you know, yes, it was hard and it hurt, but what they were saying was actually constructive, because it was helping me. It was a more experienced pair of eyes helping me to make something that I had made even better than it already was, you know. So yeah, I really had to get over myself with that and just say, okay, these guys are actually on my side and they're doing this because they want the best for my project. So if I'm offended about this, then that's my problem, and if I'm devastated about this, then I just need to, you know, see this for what it really is.
Now, do you think that we all suffer from that? Because I think part of that is pride. And I personally, lately, in the last few years, I've become to think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I've, you know, based on my personal experience, I've come to think that pride is somewhat of a defense mechanism.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah, I think so, because, I mean, the whole thing is, you know, they say that the truth hurts at times, and the first thing that gets offended, you know, by the truth is pride, you know, because our pride wants to tell us that, you know, that we're amazing and that we're perfect, and that wants everyone else to acknowledge that as well. So when someone comes in with a truth that, you know, we know is actually true, but it's not what we want to hear, you know, the initial reaction is often one, you know, of anger and devastation, and it's caused by that pride being wounded. But, you know, a person of good character will hear those things and get past the anger and devastation and say, oh, okay, but what's actually being said here? Is there value in what's being said here? Is this true? And then if they realize it is, and they say, oh, well, then, yeah, I need to let my pride go and just eat a slice of humble pie and just take this truth on board, because, you know, I'd rather be told a painful truth than a comforting lie, I guess.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel, what do you feel is the best way to overcome that? Because I still get that way. I mean, when I build something, or when I create something and it doesn't get the 5 stars that I was expecting it, because that's the 5, you know, that's the number of stars I gave it in my head, you know. Sure. I've grown up enough to where, like, I see the valid points, but in the back of my head, it still hurts.
Yeah, I mean, it still does for me a little bit as well, but I know that, you know, I'm far, far less bothered about that sort of thing than what I used to be. And the reason for that is just as I've, you know, continued to sort of, you know, grow more comfortable with myself, grow more confident in my own skin, and continue to shed the wrong thinking that's caused the struggles I've had in my life, I've found that those things bother me less and less as time goes on. So it's not an instantaneous quick fix thing. It is a process.
Do you think maybe it's normal that it's still that it would still hurt, and do you think maybe the maturity part is how you deal with it?
Yeah, I do think it's definitely normal that it still hurts. I mean, anything that's important to you and that is precious to you, and if someone has a go at it, even if what they say is true, I think it's always going to hurt to some degree. But, you know, our maturity and our character is defined by our response to that. Do we sit there and go, oh, you know, you hurt me, so, you know, get stuffed, you know, rah, rah, rah. Do we do that, or do we just, you know, be a bit more mature and just say, okay, yes, this was hard to hear. I feel offended, you know, but, you know, I should also listen to this and hear what's being said, because there may be some value in what they're saying that can help make this thing of mine that I love even better than what it already is.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, and that's the, I mean, I think that's true with anything in life, because, I mean, yes, you've wrote a great book on battling depression, but I'm willing to bet you still get depressed, and it comes down to how you deal with it.
Yeah, I do still go through down periods from time to time. Once again, significantly less than what it used to be, and I find I bounce back higher than I used to. But yeah, as I say, just basically, you know, it's how you deal with it. Do you choose to stay there and just remain in a place and you know, complain about everything, or do you choose to sit there and say, well, you know, this hurts, but, you know, I can find a way out of this. I've done it before. I can learn something more about myself from this, and I'll also gain some more knowledge that I can hopefully pass on to someone else.
Now, do you think depression in particular, you know, is an emotion just like happiness is, just like anger is, you know? I mean, do you think that when it comes to it, it is an emotion?
I think there's definitely emotions in it, but I don't think the emotions are the cause of it. I think the emotions are sort of the result of what's driving it, whatever that may be, because, you know, if it's circumstantial depression, like, you see, if lost a job or something like that, then, you know, you're bound to feel sort of depressive emotions, but they're you know, from the cause of it. If it's generational stuff that's been passed down to you from your family, then, you know, you'll have negative emotions, but they'll be caused from that. And if it's from lack of medication, it can be caused from that as well.
Well, let's thank you very, very much for talking to us about this, Graham. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
So let's wrap this up with where we can find No Way Out But Through.
Sure. It's on Amazon, and it's also on Barnes & Noble, iTunes. In fact, it's available just about everywhere that good books are sold. It's on Book Depository. Just about anywhere, really.